It is Monday, March 3rd, 2014, and this is episode 57 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and joining me tonight, as usual, is Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, and I most assuredly do have a case of the Mondays.
Yes, yes, you do.
But, you know, that's why they make beer.
I did get to talk to Bob.
Really? How's Bob doing?
Bob is okay.
He's in the Ukraine at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He's missing a few teeth. Mm. Yeah, that
important?
Happens.
Important teeth?
No, no, the back ones.
Oh. How'd that happen?
Well, I mean, you can imagine how you might lose back teeth. It's not usually in a fight.
I'm afraid to keep going down this conversation.
Anyhow, yeah, Bob wanted to pass on the message that if you, let's say, have as a strategy to lock your former employees out as they leave, just changing their password, you might want to make sure they don't have SSH keys set up.
Oh, yes.
You know, he pointed out that, you know, people always forget the SSH keys. So you might want to think about those as your fellow administrators leave the company.
Yeah. And so out of curiosity, what might happen if you forget about said keys?
Well, see, your former employees can exact whatever kind of revenge they like, especially if that system has, is somehow remotely accessible from the internet.
Ouchie.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently it was pretty ugly.
Well, yeah. Well, no. Good advice from Bob. How can you possibly argue with that?
From what he said, it's that it doesn't have anything to do with this whole Ukraine thing, though. Mm. Totally coincidental.
Completely isolated incident.
That's right. Anyhow, so we have a lovely lineup of stories, primarily again from Network World. And by the way, we were talking about this before the show. It's not intentional, right? We're not shills for Network World. I actually went through about, I'd say, 30 or 40 different sources. I didn't hit every one of the 90 sites in my RSS feed, but I was looking for other stuff, and there's just a bunch of crap last week.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it was RSS, right? RSS. RSA. So you had nothing but, press releases about how their latest version of technology is leveraging their strategy synergies to maximize positive outcomes in your war against APT, advanced cyber threat.
Ooh, you're good at that. Wow. Oh, I did see an onslaught of source code analyzers that caught the Apple go-to-fail bug. I was, quite impressed by that.
After the fact, sure.
After the fact, yes.
What's funny is normally you do actually see some interesting stuff at RSA, mergers or acquisitions or, the biggest news that came out of RSA was, the speech given by Colbert. And
yes,
that's kind of, yes. I don't know what that says about our industry right now.
But was an interesting,
and TrustyCon.
Yeah, and TrustyCon. Yeah. It was a bit of a muted week. I was surprised by that.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I guess we will continue on our on the full disclosure tear. I continue to see lots of activity. I figured it would kind of slow down after RSA ended, but it's still kind of active. But anyhow, our first story tonight is about a company called Meetup.com, who I had never heard of.
Oh, really? I've used them a bunch. They're pretty cool.
Apparently, you and just about everybody else on the planet.
Well, this is difficult to accept, but believe it or not, I am slightly social.
I know.
And you are a full-time hermit, so.
That's true.
But yes, I have used meetup.com, and it's a cool little site.
So meetup.com received a, basically an extortion threat where for the low price of $300, an attacker would not DDoS them. And meetup.com decided not to capitulate and proceeded to be DDoSed off the internet 3 times in a row, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of last week. And I thought it was kind of interesting that they came out and kind of did the full disclosure thing about this. You don't see that a lot, and it kind of got me wondering how often this happens, and they just pay it because it's $300, you know?
Well, meetup.com had some really good points, was that, and I agree with them. I'm glad they did this, but their point was that this might have been just an opening salvo, and as soon as you pay the $300, then it's $3,000, then it's $30,000, et cetera,
right.
Et cetera.
Right.
Which is, pretty common behavior when someone's blackmailing you.
Now, like you said, they did have a couple of good points in there. And one of them that I had a hard time with, I guess, is they said while the ransom or the extortion amount was pretty low, only $300, they were concerned, as you said, that, this was just the first, the opening bid, if you will. Because the attacks seem really sophisticated. What concerns me, and I see this a lot lately, is everything is really sophisticated. Everything is really sophisticated. And I wonder, was it really that sophisticated? Obviously, we don't know the details.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to say, is that sadly, although they published their thought process and the timeline of events, they did not publish any technical details about the exact makeup of the attack, the 3 different defensive techniques that they employed, though I can make a guess at 1 or 2 of them involving DNS. I would love to have heard more about what techniques I actually dove into, because that's what I care about. Yeah. What did they do? Because DDoS is such a tough problem to solve, and it really, really has to do with what you've done ahead of time. How you've structured it, how you've gamed out, how what your planned reactions are going to be, are you working with your ISP, all that stuff that, we can learn from a DDoS, but I would love for them to publish what techniques they use to mitigate it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think they had a really good point that it's very important not to feed the trolls, basically. because again, if it wasn't them, if it wasn't that particular attacker coming back around, they will probably get a reputation for paying ransom and
yep.
The next script kid coming down the street will hear about it and go after them too. So I think it was a good thing. It's painful, right?
And as far as we know, it's ongoing as of today.
Yeah,
it's still ongoing.
It's probably expensive for them too.
DDoS is a tough one, and in part because I think there's a lot of voodoo around it, and there's a lot of people who lump a whole bunch of different types of stuff into DDoS, when DDoS is more of a, it's not one technique, it's many, many techniques. And, I do think some vendors are trying to sell magic sauce that, install my box at your customer prem and you can stop DDoS. And maybe on certain types of DDoSes, but not when somebody's trying to play who's got a bigger pipe with you. That's not going to work.
When they can combine the anti-DDoS box with the anti-APT box, you got something there.
I'm working on that, actually. Patent pending.
All righty. So the next story we have comes from Network World, and the title of this story...
Before we move
go
on,
ahead. Yes.
For the record, if you want to know more about what's going on with Meetup, go to meetup.com's blog. They've got a kind of a running update and information from the CEO and all that kind of jazz. So just want to give you at least some pointer for more information.
Thank you. Or you could check out the show notes.
Hey, even better.
Absolutely. How about that?
I'm so glad I don't have to write those.
Got your back, man. All right.
Okay.
The next story we have is titled How to Test the Security Savvy of Your Staff. And there's a few unique ideas in here. I think there's a lot of what I would call well-trodden paths here, right? So administer quizzes during security training, but they also recommend doing it periodically throughout the year, other times. And that got me wondering, and they don't give any examples in the article, but how do you do that, right? Do you just like pop something up on their computer or send them an email? I'm not sure of the venue on how you would do that. That logistically sounds like a bit of a challenge to me, but it's not a bad idea.
Pull them into a dark room and ask them how many lights they see over and over again.
Hey, there you go. It's a good idea.
Hopefully somebody gets that reference.
Does this hurt? All right. The next one they had was random checks of workspaces. So this is the perennial clean desk policy. And boy, after my company got acquired by a bigger company, I had all kinds of problems here.
Well, this is also the same. You know, that same company that you and I used to work for also had a notorious practice of if someone found your desktop or laptop unlocked, they would send an email as you to certain mailing lists that incurred most of the company with relatively embarrassing things about you.
Oh, yes.
That's, a detriment. I was never a fan of this practice. I thought it was sort of encouraging bad behavior, but I will tell you it was effective.
And it was funny at times.
It was. But it just
depending on who got it, yes.
It strayed very close to that line of ethics and I was never completely comfortable with it. But that was the culture of the company and a lot of people employed it and it was a good way of raising awareness. I don't support it, but I understand why they did it and that was not a fight I was ever prepared to win. So I let that one go. But point being that you're also looking for unlocked desktops or laptops.
Yeah, my problem was I used to have, manage a global team. And when people from other countries would come, they would bring presents, like usually in the form of alcohol. And so I had a cabinet that had, affectionately become the liquor cabinet and it didn't have a lock on it. Well, so, the clean desk auditors had a field day with that.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
Yeah, those were fun times. But by the way, just in case you're wondering what Andy was just describing, we had a company mailing list where everybody could, anybody in the company could send an email. And looking back on this was a really bad idea. But we had an email address that you could send to, and it would go to the entire company.
You could unsubscribe yourself from it if you wanted to.
Correct. Right. Yeah. But everybody had, everybody could send to it, and so what would happen is if you left your computer, let's say I left my computer unlocked, somebody, let's say Andy, would walk up to my computer while I wasn't there and send out an email, and it would not be a kind email. It would be professing my love for some other coworker or farm animal or whatever the case may be. And you only made that mistake once.
Hopefully.
Generally, I think there were a few that made it more than once.
And this mailing list was kind of a digital water cooler, right? It was meant for social interaction with your employees and, there's something to be said for that, but interesting things did occur on the mailing list.
Oh, yeah. By the way, the acquiring company had a real problem with that list.
I can't imagine why. Anyway.
Anyhow, the next idea they offer up are social engineering. And this was a pretty cool idea. So either taking a little-known employee or a contractor or let's say a consultant and sending them into your business and seeing if they can con documents or whatnot out of people, you know, kind of in person.
Yep.
You know, we all talk about doing it over, you know, over the phone or by email, which is actually is number four. But this is a pretty good idea, I thought.
And yeah, I love this idea. And you can even hire professionals to do it too. A company I happen to work for does that sort of stuff as well. Not that I'm shilling for them, but just in general, you know, and you'll find it's highly effective. And it's a good, it's the, you know, social engineering equivalent of a pen test, right? That shows, look how vulnerable we are to this.
Right. So number four, simulated phishing attacks. I hope everybody's doing this already. I can't imagine people aren't doing this.
Oh yeah, tons of people are not. You know, it depends on the size of your company, but I would say the vast majority of companies do not do simulated phishing email attacks. And again, not shilling for my company. My company does some of this, not my company, the company I work for. And it's highly effective. We have typically get 45-50% success rate.
Yeah, I think there's even free services to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I'm surprised to hear that there are that many companies not doing it. But it's a kind of basic and simple thing to do.
It is, but talk it through for a moment, right? You've got a relatively decent sized organization, and you're struggling with security to begin with. Let's say you do one of these, and you do get a 45% pop rate. Then what? It's one of those, what's your policy going to be on it? What are you trying to establish by doing this?
Layoffs.
This is why we shouldn't drink during the podcast.
Yes.
But no, my point is, although I'm a big fan of doing this and I would highly encourage it, I would think about, what are you trying to achieve before you do this? Are you just simply trying to demonstrate to the users how quickly they can be phished? Is this going to be backed up by user education? Is this going to be backed up by showing that you should put some sort of email security box or technology in place? You know, what's your goal of doing the phishing email attacks? Do you want to test how many people report it up to your IT organization, how your IT organization responds to it, how quickly they notice it and send out an email? I mean, there's a lot of things that you could be trying to do here, and I would just say have your goal in mind when you do it, but definitely do it.
Yeah, one of the most effective ideas and you know, I don't have data to back this up, but at least in my mind, it works this way. Is to do this, but let people know that you are doing it. So you know, institute a process where you are going to be phishing your employees, but make it very clear that you're going to do it. You know, make an announcement. Hey, you know, we are going to be phishing you throughout the year. Be on the lookout. And the idea being that it will attune people, because now they're going to be looking for what they know is coming. I thought that was a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
But you know, I actually have had some philosophical debates recently with some, unnamed people about phishing and what to do, because, you know, there is, I know we talked about this in a number of different stories, right? But we all want to hold people accountable for when they click on a phishing email, right? But at what point do you say that a phishing email is so legitimate looking that it isn't, you know, that they couldn't have reasonably not fallen for it? And so that's a difficult, it's a very subjective problem.
It is. It's an incredibly difficult problem. And I don't know how to fix that one. I really don't. I think user awareness helps, but holding them accountable, although I'm such a big fan of that, it's a tough one because these are engineered to fool people. So building in a healthy level of skepticism as much as you can to your users, but as I've often said on the show, I don't think user awareness training is incredibly effective.
Right.
I think a test like this is, you know, I think user awareness training has a short-term, you know, awareness, but quickly erodes. And if you're not backing up with the technical control, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, and it kind of cuts both ways because I have sent out communications with some very, very clear, and I thought personally, you know, because since I wrote them, some very nice guides on how to identify phishing emails. And in return, I was deluged with, you know, is this a phishing email? And it was all legitimate stuff.
Yeah, that is the downside. Yeah, it is a tough problem to fix. It really is. You know, and I've seen some interesting technical controls around this, and I'm not, you know, recommending anyone in particular, but one particular company that I've worked with, Proofpoint, is interesting in that it watches URLs coming in via emails and then goes and sees what's at the other end of the URL and tries to figure out if it's malicious or not. And based on that, we'll basically rewrite the URL in the email transparently to the user and basically send them to a sandbox instead, or not a sandbox, but almost a black hole, Proofpoint site, and say, hey, you know, where this was sending you is probably malicious. Are you really, really, really sure you want to go there? Or not even give them that option.
That's what I think it takes, honestly. It's going to take things like that. You know, but even that, you know, we get a lot of attachments. You know, I probably get 5 or 6 times a week really convincing emails, which, you know, I don't know if they're mass phishes or if someone's legitimately trying to spearfish me. I'm really not sure. I'm not under any misconceptions that I'm that important, right? But I think they're probably mass emails, but they look really legitimate and they have malicious attachments. I don't know how Proofpoint would handle that, but, you know, we've got to get to the point where we aren't relying on people to not get our network zoned. I mean, whether or not somebody clicks on something on their desktop shouldn't be the determinant of whether or not we're compromised.
Yeah, and to be clear, Proofpoint is not the perfect solution for all things. It helps a bit in a certain area. There isn't a perfect solution, and you're right. We have to get people to stop relying on the individual user decision. But unless we take away a lot of capabilities to do things on the endpoints, so that the attack fails without the user having a choice one way or the other, we're going to have problems.
That's true. Well, we beat that one to death.
Yes.
The last item they had in this list was follow-up on tests. So, you know, basically, once you run these tests and you have results, make sure you follow up on the results. You know, go back to the people who fell for the phishes or who fell for the social engineers or who had the confidential information sitting on their desks and do something, you know, whether it's train them or reprimand them but, you know, follow up on it because, you know, it's not only will it help then, I think there is this intangible that people recognize that if you don't have your guard up, you're going to get caught and called out and, you know, It's kind of the herd immunity concept.
The one thing I would add is if you're using any sort of managed service provider, test them. Make sure they're doing what they said they're supposed to do. If there's any sort of alerting and escalation that they should be doing, test it regularly. Make sure everything's configured properly, they're watching properly, and they're escalating properly.
That's a very good point.
I cannot tell you the number of times I have found out customers, well, so-and-so managed service company is handling that for us. And for whatever reason, something was broken in the infrastructure, broken in the process, and things just didn't get caught.
Yeah. And maybe it's not set up to work the way you think it works. Maybe they're not going to do the kinds of things you think they're going to do. So that's a really good point. So the next lovely story we have comes also from Network World. And this story is called Why Companies Need to Check Their Handling of Insider Threats. And this was a kind of a interesting stats in this story. So they go through a survey, and the survey was done by a company called IS Decisions. And they found that only 21% of responses from the, I think it was 500 IT professionals working in organizations from 50 to 10,000 employees, only 21% put insider threats in the top three threat category. And there was another survey by, I think it was Forrester, if I'm not mistaken, found that 36% of incidents were a result of insiders. So, you know, I don't know what the other 64% were, but I would imagine that that's possibly a majority, and it doesn't rise to the top of the radar for most people, and that's kind of concerning. So they had some recommendations here, which I thought were good. Number one was to stop password sharing, which is...
I think the technical response to that is, duh.
But they did find out that 1 in 5 people share their passwords. And I can anecdotally tell you, this is a really significant problem. And in a lot of the incidents I have worked in the past, password sharing has played a part. And it's a really significant problem. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with people honestly wanting or doing what they think is right, right? At least at the time.
They're not being malicious at all.
Right.
They're just...
But it ends up backfiring on them because the person they share their password with is misrepresenting why they want the password, or, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I've seen some really ugly situations where, you know, Joe shared his password with Sally. Sally shared it with 4 people, and each of those people shared it with 6 people, and you know, it was everywhere, and so it is an important problem, and there's fortunately some really good solutions like 2-factor that can very cleanly address that problem, but you know, I don't see it being done a lot. Another item they have. And they recommend approaching this from a technology perspective, but I'll just say it in the more generic terms, which is to limit where and when people can log into your systems.
Sure.
Which makes a lot of sense. And, you know, that's kind of the, I think the last two, both that one and the sharing password, probably largely arise from the Edward Snowden mess. The next item they have, or next suggestion they have, is to make security policies clear and accessible to employees. And, you know, they basically say that, you know, it's sometimes often problematic for employees to find their policies, or when they do find them, they're buried inside manuals or whatnot. So making them clear and accessible is important. I think that's a good one. And then the last suggestion they have, and I have mixed feelings about this, is to provide constant reminders of their security obligations. And on the one hand, I can say that's not a bad idea, but on the other hand, God, that would drive me crazy. So
people would tune it out too, is the problem.
Yes. Right. So you got to figure out where that balance is. But, you know, hey, if you go and you read the book called, what is it called? Damn it. It's Dan Ariely's book on dishonesty. I can't remember the title of it right now. But anyhow, there's actually some social science behind the concept of, you know, let's say a terms of service or whatever, that... It actually does psychologically work on a percentage of people, so it's not a bad idea if you can do it right. But again, you got to walk the balance, right? You got to strike the right balance.
Are you thinking of predictably rational?
No, that's the first book.
The Honest book, Truth About Dishonesty?
That's the book. Thank you. I just finished that book, and I promptly forgot the title. It's an excellent book, by the way.
So good you forgot the title.
So good. Well, you know, I started reading it a long time ago. And
so if you're curious, Dan Ariely, A-R-I-E-L-Y.
Yes. All three books are fantastic. They do not have a damn thing to do with information security. But when you read them, you realize they have so many applications to security, it's not funny. So, you know, read the books. Make yourself smarter. Anyhow, next story is 6 lessons learned about the scariest security threats.
Now, to be clear, there's a little bit of cheese in here.
Oh, there's a lot of cheese in here.
Let's just get that on the table right up front.
There's a whole lot of cheese in here. And, you know, this is a frustrated incident responder writing stories about some of his experiences, but there's some cool stuff in here.
Yeah.
And so the first lesson learned is APTIs are monitoring you. And, you know, the just kind of net that whole page and a half of discourse out. He basically worked on an incident that where an organization was completely compromised, and they were very, very careful about not tipping their hand to the attackers who had complete control of the environment, and they were going to do a big bang kick out, right? And what they later found was that the attackers were watching their planning activities through compromised video conferencing equipment in the conference rooms, which, you know, okay, I can see that, right? But Jesus Christ, you know, if you're in a conference room talking about really sensitive stuff and you got like Polycom stuff pointing at you, maybe you should go turn it off. I don't know. That's just me, maybe. But anyhow, I think to me, the takeaway here was not specifically that problem, but if you are in a situation where your network is owned and owned hard, right, you need to approach it with the understanding that somebody's possibly reading and watching what you're doing, and you need to be careful, right? Because, you know, you don't want to tip your hand, right? You want to make sure you do things on your timeline and they don't know what you're doing. And if they're, for instance, able to read your email, you know, that could be a really problematic thing. So that was the lesson I took away from it. Not the Polycom thing. Hopefully everybody knows that already. Jeez. All right. Number 2, not all APTs are advanced as experts think. And this was a really long way of saying that the attackers didn't know how to use the tools. And this is something that I have been thinking for a little while, that in large measure, a lot of the, quote, advanced attacks are perpetrated by people following scripts.
It's the only way it scales.
Yes. Somebody has scripted out, if you see this, then you do that. If you see this, then you do that. And when they get to something that doesn't look like something that matches up to their script, it either falls apart or they have to fall back to something that, you know, like a plan B. And so, you know, I think this is something that really bothers me when I read about all these attacks, you know, how advanced the attack was. I honestly don't think the attacks are all necessarily all that advanced, as much as they've just been kind of packaged up. So maybe the attack is advanced in quotes, but I don't necessarily think that has any bearing on who's doing it.
It only needs to be as advanced as it needed to be to get to what they're trying to get to.
Correct.
And it could be a very basic thing that works. But, you know, just like defenders, attackers come in all shapes and sizes, and they're not all good.
Right. Absolutely. Let's see. Number three, the medicine may be the poison. And yet another whole page lamentation about how this consultant works as a subordinate to other incident response companies. And he sees these incident response companies take the opportunity of a severe outbreak to sell, you know, let's say their anti-APT wares. You know, I can only assume they're talking about Mandiant Red Line or whatever.
Yeah, that was my assumption, but they're not called out in here, but the way they describe it, it sure as heck sounds like Mandiant.
But the point is that in this particular case, he you know, he did some after work on this with this company and setting up a honeypot, and sure enough, after they set up the honeypot, they found that systems were still compromised, and when they did some forensics, they found out that a Trojan had been installed on some of the workstations, which had the same name as the anti-APT tool. Which, you know, hey, if I were an APT guy, that's what I'd do.
Yep.
Not complicated, right?
This is where, you know, hashes come in handy. Just saying.
Just saying, absolutely. They haven't figured that part out yet. All right, let's see. Number four, all your PKI base belong to us. Yeah, one more whole page dissertation about a customer who basically had a certificate authority, and that certificate authority ran lots of stuff, like they generated badges. So, you know, smart card badges with keys generated by the CA. Well, these attackers apparently found that the CA lived inside a virtual machine that was just shut down. And so they apparently compromised the hypervisor or the backend storage and siphoned off the disk image, and apparently remotely brute forced the administrator login password, which, you know, it's probably pretty easy to do, and then generated a subordinate certificate, and then started creating their own sets of smart cards, and then apparently physically entered the building and did who knows what. So that was number five. Don't forget the accounts you're not supposed to touch. So, you know, this is actually a really important one, and I've seen this a lot. He points out that there's a particular account in Active Directory called KRB TGT, which is a Kerberos user ID and used for Kerberos authentication. And if you change the password, all sorts of nasty bad things happen, and you got to do a lot of work. So people don't like to change that password. But I think in most companies, there's a lot of accounts like that. You know, whether it's database service accounts or application accounts where, you know, the guy that wrote the application and left 15 years ago told us never to change that password. And, you know, we never changed that password. But if you don't change the password, you're very likely to get compromised again. And in this particular case, he points out a situation where a company did a lot of work to change all their passwords, even the really painful ones, but they didn't change this KRB TGT because I guess they didn't know it was there, or they didn't, they thought it didn't need to be changed. Anyway, they didn't change it, and it's well known to a lot of the APT elite that it doesn't get changed, and sure enough, they used it to get back into the company. So change everything. And then number six is that APTs struggle with the data explosion, and they need to be selective. And the point there is that, you know, a long time ago, it was relatively easy to steal all of your data. But now it's very difficult because, you know, we've got many, many, many terabytes of information, and it's not practical to steal it all. And so they've got to work to figure out what they're going to steal. And so there's possibly some opportunity in there to detect them indexing your stuff or whatnot. So that was that. And the next story we have is how IT can establish better cloud control. Get it? Cloud control. So this article has all sorts of crazy stats. And, you know, I would say a lot of them aren't directly related to SaaS or, you know, or cloud, but they kind of point to, you know, maybe some fundamental, yeah, I don't know, psychological problems people have when they move to the cloud. I don't know, right? But the first stat they have is that 25% of SaaS app users will display their passwords on notes, while only 10.2% of non-SaaS users do the same. What the hell's that about?
Yeah, I, you know, correlation is not causality, but I have no idea. That is crazy.
SaaS app users are 10 times more likely to store their passwords on unprotected or unshared or shared drives than their counterparts. The study found 21% of SaaS app users store their passwords on unprotected or shared drives, so only 2.1% of non-SaaS users do this. God, what's wrong with these people? And it keeps going, you know. Let's see, people using SaaS apps for work are 3 times more likely than non-SaaS app users to keep user passwords in an unprotected document. Age plays in a component. Study found 28.5% of 20-somethings keep their app passwords in plain sight, compared to what, 10.8% of baby boomers. And the crazy stats keep going. SaaS app users are 2 times more likely to email work files they need to a personal account than non-SaaS users.
I mean, the only thing I can think of here is that if it's non-SaaS, you're probably using some sort of federated password management like Active Directory, and it's all tied together, right? And, you know, I think the easy answer here is provide your users and train them how to use something like a password vault of some variety and show them how to, you know, capture it, create random passwords, have it autofill those passwords, protect that password, you know, give them some technology or tools that they can use so they're not having to remember all these passwords on their own. Or, as it says later in the article, tie this stuff into your single sign-on.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, I think that was really where they were trying to drive you. But God, the stats they throw out in here are really hard to believe.
I think it, yeah, I think it's because it's not AD, I think is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Or similar.
I suppose you're right. But some things, even then, some things like, you know, being twice as likely to email work files to a personal account doesn't have a lot to do with passwords.
That's true.
And, you know, I suspect what you just mentioned is very true, but I suspect there's also potentially this, you know, this psychological element that you're not working on company systems when you're using a SaaS application. Mm. And so the barriers are much more porous, and so people might feel more, you know, empowered. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to explain any other way. What other crazy ones. SaaS app users are 16 times more likely to access work files through an app that IT doesn't know they have than non-SaaS app users. 16 wow. times. You know, I guess the point there to me, what number one is what you'd mentioned, you know, if you have the ability, use your Active Directory or use your access management function integrated into your single sign-on, however that works for you. But that seems like a very sensible thing. But man, some of these stats are really concerning. And to me, possibly point out that, you know, maybe there's some more targeted user education or policy kinds of controls or even technical controls that need to be put in place if you adopt SaaS environments. And I guess also assuming you believe that these stats are in fact true.
Right. So the question is, who paid for the study and who conducted the study? And, you know, but let's take on face value that there's something to this. Definitely something to take a look at.
Yeah, it was the Blackstone Group and Soft Choice. I don't know who Soft Choice is, but they probably have something to do with cloud access management, I bet.
No, they're a big multi, you know, discipline sort of fulfillment house. They do a lot of services, a lot of product. They, you know, they're kind of like a CDW. They do a lot of different things.
Interesting. So the last story we have is, this is interesting. So the SANS top 20 critical cybersecurity controls has apparently been embraced by a new group called the Council on Cybersecurity. And that group has released version 5 of those controls. So there's a new version of the top 20 critical controls. And I've spent some time looking through them. I can't actually find where the differences are. I think some of the details in some of the specific controls might be a little bit different. But, you know, the old version versus the new version, I think the new version is about 16 pages longer. So there's something in there. But they did have something in here which I thought was worth calling out. And they had what they call their first five quick wins. And this is very similar to what we talked about last week with the Defense Signals Directorate paper on their ranking of controls. So this is kind of this council's view on that. So number one was application whitelisting. No surprise. Number two, use of standard secure system configurations. Number three, patch application software within 48 hours. Number four, patch system software within 48 hours. And number five, reduce the number of users with administrative privileges, which seems like a good list. So...
you know, they've got one more that I saw. Well, it supports... Okay, I see it supports the first five, which is vulnerability management and scanning tools. I see. I see that, how they've got that laid out.
Yeah, this is not new to it, but they also have what they call the five critical tenets of an effective cyber defense system. And I thought these were pretty cool.
Hang on, I'm putting some marks on my bingo card.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, not quite there yet. Let's keep going.
All right. These are really good, I think, from the perspective of trying to figure out the philosophy behind your policies, right? So number one was offense informs defense. So basically, learn from your security incidents. And use those to feedback into the things that you're doing and your defenses, which is kind of the concept of continuous improvement that every other discipline has had for decades. Number two is prioritization. And what they say there is invest first in controls that will provide the greatest risk reduction and protection against the most dangerous threat actors, and that can be feasibly implemented in your computing environment. Makes sense. Number three is metrics. I think we all know that one. Number four is continuous diagnostics and mitigation. And number five is automation. So, you know, I think those are a really good kind of framework for how to think about your security program, whatever you're doing, right? But I think those are kind of good general thoughts.
Yep. And it's a big 106 page document, so
it is
not a whole lot else I want to add there. It's some interesting stuff. Well worth reading.
Yeah.
But
you know,
or at least skimming.
Right. And you know, they've got if you go to the Council on Cybersecurity's website, they've got the 20 controls mapped to NERC SIP and to ISO 27002 and several other things. So it's becoming a pretty well established standard. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I wonder what's missing from it. You know, it's intended to be the top controls, not like completely comprehensive. So anyway, that's what it's for. And that is the last story we have. So with that, any closing remarks?
No, though. Now I feel like we should make buzzword bingo cards to send out to our listeners and they can play along.
Oh, we could do a little website thing, you know, or
yeah,
it'll be Java and Flash and
it'll have no malware whatsoever.
None at all.
No.
Anyhow.
No, it's been good, Joe. Thanks for all the great info. And as always, we'd love to hear feedback. If you liked anything, didn't like anything, hated it, loved it, we put you to sleep, drop us a line. Let us know. Jerry will give you all the contact info, and we love hearing from our listeners and hope you find this valuable.
Absolutely. And as Andy said, you can send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can actually find the show notes. So links to all of the different stories we talk about are in the show notes. You can find all the old episodes in there as well. And there's links to other cool stuff. You can find the show on Twitter at DefensiveSec. You can follow Mr. Kellett on Twitter at Lurg. You can follow me on Twitter at MaliciousLink. But please don't be creepy. And with that, yeah, it's been a great week. Thanks very much for hanging with us, and we'll talk again next time. Take care.
See you guys.